When I first got to Russia, it wasn't until 1989 that I was able to go, that they would have me, and my former employers would let me go. That was exactly what I saw. And on the street and everywhere, I mean, a country that can't run a grocery shop in a main town, can't, it was just everything was being wrecked and burglarized for this ludicrous Rolls-Royce they were building in the middle of their economy, the defense system. And I was convinced, firstly, that they had the capacity to start a war but not to wage it, and secondly, that they simply couldn't hold their own country together, their whole empire together, any longer.
That was John Le Carré speaking in 2002 for the Acorn DVD release of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. This is the Le Carré Cast. Hi, everybody, and welcome back. I am here again with author Adam Brooks to discuss Single and Single. And I'm really excited to continue our part two of our discussion. If you missed part one, please go back, listen to that. I think you're going to enjoy it. So this novel is really, in my mind, it felt like walking back the cat, right? That's what Oliver is doing. He's kind of going back the chain to try and figure out what happened to blow up Tiger Single's whole relationship with this Russian, not mafiosa, but like a kind of oligarch, right? And so we do get a number of interesting little bits. He kind of goes through and meets everybody involved in all of Tiger's stuff. So we get Gupta, the manservant that Tiger Single had, that had his family living in the basement of the Single and Single place, which when he goes into Single and Single, that was a really fun moment in the book where we kind of, the whole place kind of comes alive in his mind, and you see the ghosts of all of these people that Tiger has built around him. I did kind of like that bit of the book there.
Yeah, there were some great set pieces like that. And a lot of it is, there's some great sort of tense set pieces, like in that moment where he's making his way through the offices of Single and Single at night, looking for documents that can help him. He's surprised by Gupta the Mansur. And I enjoyed too, I really enjoyed the portrayal of the Russian oligarchs. I just felt it captured, it was very atmospheric. These are very crooked Russians who have a great big place, a great big estate out in Georgia. And there's a rather wonderful evocation of kind of life in Georgia and wonderful food. A particular moment in Russia where everything felt kind of unbound and unchained and strange and possible. Things were just flying apart in all directions. And the villain of the story, Alex Hoban, who is this crooked Russian lawyer, is murmuring on his mobile phone all the time. This is published in 1998, so phones were not quite what they are today. And the image of the crooked Russian murmuring on his mobile phone, is sitting in corners, just murmuring on his phone all the time. And when they're out of cell phone reach, he has a special phone attached to a big box, a sat phone of some sort, that he's murmuring into all the time. This image of this guy just murmuring in corners is really powerful. It just goes the whole way through the book, and it captures a wonderful sort of sinister, strange 90s moment. Because that was a truly weird time. None of us knew what to make of Russia at the time. I mean, it was completely bizarre and compelling. And I was based in Asia as a reporter, you know, through most of the 90s, in Southeast Asia, then in China. And there were just these Russians everywhere. And he had no idea what to make of any of them. Some of them were journalists. Are they journalists, though? What were they doing there? You know, and these diplomats, Russian diplomats, that would, you know, you'd see on the weekends down the market selling stuff out of the back of a truck. And you know, I can remember sitting with the TASS correspondent in Jakarta in a bar one night, and we were having a beer together, wonderful guy, who was as mystified by what was going on as everybody else. And we were sitting in this bar, and in came this quite well-known Russian diplomat who was a big name on the scene in Jakarta. And I leaned over to Valerie, the TASS correspondent, and I said, that guy's KGB, isn't he? I was told he was KGB. He's not a tip, is he? He's a spook. And Valerie leaned back over to me and went, not anymore. And it was just this sort of crazy time. And we had stories of the Russian military starving. You know, their soldiers didn't have enough to eat, and their institutions were falling apart, and their embassies were falling to bits. And like Harry captures that really chaotic feel that underpinned so much of the early mid-90s very, very well. And the villainousness and the kind of barbarity. And I love that.
Yeah, well, and, you know, Alex Hoban, he also is rumored to have those kind of intelligence connections in the past as well, I think, at some point. So there is this kind of intermingling where you don't know who's up and who's down. And even, you know, the Russian oligarch is on top of the world and then falls pretty far out, right? Because he's got these big plans for selling blood. I mean, geez, can you get even more creepy, right? This whole plan.
Right. Collecting blood pretexts in rural Russia and then selling it on the open market in the West, which kind of fabulously prefigured what really happened all over the place. I covered a story in China where they did exactly that. You know, they collected from rural farm workers in rural China and bottled it up and sold it on the international market. So it was all contaminated with HIV. And, you know, the blood thing was a huge story through the late 90s and the early 2000s in post-communist societies. It was a trope. It was a feature of those times. And again, Le Carré just completely nails the sort of biopolitics, right? What the critics would call biopolitics of the time was, again, he's just got a nose for these larger underlying themes and the motifs that illustrate them so perfectly. The blood, the mobile phone, you know, this gun is not a gun, the legal language. He's got a set of antennae that are just much greater than everybody else's. Sniff out in the air around us the real kind of currents of thought and politics and action before they take shape for anybody else. And that's what makes him such a terrific writer.
Well, and we see him return to that kind of Russian theme so often. You know, I mean, you'd think, even though the Cold War ended, so many of his books continued to revolve around Russia as an antagonist or at least a player in his novels, right? And what do you think of that? Like, because he did bristle at the idea that he was a Cold War novelist, yet he couldn't quite get away from Russia.
He couldn't get away from Russia, but, you know, neither can we. I mean, look at where we are today, right? I mean, we seem unable to escape the orbit of this deeply damaged country that we can't free ourselves from it. I mean, here we are back at war on the plains of Eastern Europe with Russia, for God's sake. We may be fighting a proxy war, but, you know, we're at war on some level. They were interfering in our presidential campaign for multiple years. And at the same time, you know, when you go to London, and if you walk through some of the most expensive bits of London, Kensington, walk down Shepherd Market at lunchtime, dinner time, walk through the restaurants, listen to the bars, you hear a lot of Russian getting spoken. London is full of Russians. You know, they own big chunks of the media. They own soccer clubs. They are deeply in cahoots with British politicians. So we can't get away from them either. And again, I think Le Carré understood something about the way that country and its operatives and its state managed somehow to insinuate themselves into our lives just repeatedly. They sort of shapeshift into the lives of Western democracies over and over and over again. Weird little Russian spies turning up in Democratic congressional campaigns in California, you know, turning up a Republican presidential campaign. They just pop up everywhere, all over the place. What are they doing? Why is Russianness such a thing for us? And why can we not escape it? And Le Carré gets that, right? I mean, he gets that in a way that he never got, but didn't even really try to get Asia, tried to get China. He always stepped back when it came to thinking about China. But yes, Russia is, and the other place that exerts such a hold on his imagination is Germany, of course, Germany, Switzerland, because he spent such 14 years himself. But they recur again and again too.
But, you know, the interesting thing that I think he puts his finger on in Single and Single 2 is why that happens is there's a moment where at the end, Oliver is trying to get to Tiger, right? He has this moment where he realizes what his dad had taught him. Money solves all the problems, right? Because he's got this suitcase of cash and that's how he's able to do it. And I think that that theme of we have a problem, we're going to throw money at it. And I think that's why you see all of these Russians popping up all over the place, right? They have the money to spend and money talks, especially in the US and democracy, but also all over the place, right? And I think that's a theme that we kind of see in this book a little bit.
Yeah, also some sort of, I think you're right. I think all of, you know, Le Carré's characters, his world is defined by these kind of sort of ghastly aspirational view of a world of high finance and high living that is removed from the concerns of ordinary mortals like you and me. But isn't there also some sort of deeper motive kind of impulse in his Russians? He puts his finger very well on a kind of weird destructiveness that his Russian characters have. I mean, Alex Hoban in Single and Single is ready just to tear everything down. He just doesn't care. He will ruin everything and everybody, his wife, his children, his business partners, simply for some kind of perceived advantage. Money, yes, but also for some weird masculine advantage. That he's a wrecker. And doesn't that personify something that we see in our larger sense of Russia today? I mean, Putin and his people, that awful man who's head of the Wagner Group, you know, his proxies on Russian TV. These people are wreckers. They're wrecking infants. They seek to just wreck and tear down the way they are behaving in Ukraine. If they can't have it, they will wreck it. The way they behaved in Chechnya, the way they behaved in Syria, the way they behaved in Afghanistan, they can't have it. There's something in those power-crazed people who seem to end up running contemporary Russia that was absent from the Soviet Union. The Soviets understood restraint. These guys don't. And they will just destroy where they can or they want or they feel the need to. And Le Carré sort of sees that, I think, in his Russian characters. Isn't that something that we sort of feel about contemporary Russia, this deeply destructive urge?
But we do get a little bit of a... if you want to call the oligarch a good Russian versus Alex Hoban, who is a bad Russian, even though they're both not good people, you have, and I'm going to say his name wrong,
Yevgeny.
His whole thing is, right, sending money back so they can build this vineyard. He's trying to make something, right? You know, obviously, it's kind of a pipe dream by the end of the book, but he's more, he feels like there's this respectability, right? And he's the old guard, though, I guess, right? And the new guard is trying to tear that down, and that's kind of a theme, right?
But there's also that incredibly telling moment in the book where they're talking about him sending money back to build the vineyard and to back in his hometown, back in this place where they had this wonderful estate. But there's also a line where one of the characters says to Oliver says, how is Yevgeny back there at the moment? How is it all going with the vineyard? And one of the peripheral characters turns to him and says, when Yevgeny is sending a lot of money back, he's fine. When he's not sending a lot of money back, not so much.
Yeah.
So in the end, it feels like Yevgeny's grand plans, his project, his sense of himself as a man of the soil, as a true Russian who understands, you know, his roots and his place. Actually, it's still all built on these fragile, venal structures of self-regard, social status, and money. And one gets the sense as the book goes on that Yevgeny is getting hollowed out in exactly the same way that Tiger Single himself is just this hollow. That they all are just these vacuous people for whom there is this kind of howling void at the center. and that Le Carré has seen something about this arena, this larger forum of Russia, its satellites, and the West's interaction through the 90s and up to today, which has at its heart this kind of toxic void. There's just something truly awful about it. That is nothing good that comes out of interactions with Russia in the last 30 years. And it's a very bleak view, but I feel like Le Carré's got his, he's got his teeth into something.
Well, Le Carré had to, or should have owed the Russians that he visited when he, because he went over there a couple of times in the 90s, and you feel like he owes them maybe some residuals for lifting so many characteristics from them to kind of implement in some of his later novels. You do see that character of the Russian kind of oligarch reappear again and again in his later novels. And he is playing with that theme, right?
Yeah, I do. He's also, I mean, you know, I think we're kind of back to the great problem that everyone always points to with the spy novel is, you know, who is your enemy now? Who are you spying on and why are they spying? You're spying on someone, and you've got to have a good reason for spying on them, and the stakes in the novel have got to feel credible and believable, so they've got to be people worth spying on. Otherwise, your novel isn't going to work. So spy novelists are always casting around for people that are worth spying, and Russian oligarchs are obviously people worth spying on. They serve the plot very well there. And they have the added virtue that they resonate incredibly well, especially in the UK, maybe less so in the States. But the presence of big Russians in London, it's a big thing. They own, a Russian owns the main London evening paper, a Russian owns Chelsea Football Club. They're, you know, there's just, it's a big part of life. They're a great trope for the contemporary spy novel, true. And if you have Le Carré's, you know, subtlety of understanding, of where they come from and who they are, then why wouldn't you use them?
We haven't talked a lot about Brock, who is this customs officer. And, you know, one of the things we return to again and again is his interrogation of this other guy, Massingham. How did that work for you? Because it's kind of a reoccurring thing that's dropped in there every once in a while when it feels more like Le Carré just needs a break from Oliver for a second. To me, it felt like a little bit of a spinning of wheels for the plot there.
Right. So Massingham is the corrupt former British intelligence officer who works for Tiger Single's corrupt British bank. He's the fixer, the rainmaker, the posh, incredibly suave front person for the bank's operations. And he gets turned, he's burned basically by British intelligence. And much of the book is revolving around his interrogation, as you say, by the British intelligence officer, Brock. Brock in this novel feels like a little bit of a cipher to me. He's not the most fleshed out character that we find among Le Carré's British intelligence officers. He's perfectly fine. He's interesting. Yeah, he has a wife who keeps him grounded and human. It's kind of feel a little bit like Le Carré was phoning that one in a bit. He is very patient. He's very thoughtful. He's very insightful. He has those Le Carré intelligence officer traits of doggedness, of thoughtfulness, coupled with a sort of iron core that when it really counts, he can be absolutely ruthless. And this interrogation of Massingham, as you say, it pops up throughout the book. And part of it, it seems to me, is the spy novelist's way of keeping you abreast of what's actually happening in the story, because it is an awfully complicated story, single, and you need recaps at some point to let you know what's going on. Again, Le Carré is a master and just walks you through the plot to make sure that you know where you are. The greatest example of that is in Tinker Tailor, of course. We see the entire plot explained in a briefing with Saul Enderby. I mean, everything, soup to nuts. He walks you through all the complex little bits of the plot to see. And I think that the interrogation with Massingham in Single and Single does some of that. It's also a great, again, I loved it for its insight into Massingham, his sense of himself, his language, his class privilege. He's incredibly snobbish about Brock, who is a lowly customs officer. And you see the snobbery and the sense of specialness that the English establishment, intelligence establishment, has about itself in Le Carré's imaginings of this world. Something that British intelligence officers actually really hate about Le Carré. he does that. They don't like it. They don't think it's an accurate representation. Always slightly resented it. But for Le Carré, it is a central fact of his portrayal of MI6 is that it is an elitist class institution. And I loved that portrayal of Massing as the intelligent snob. I thought it was great. But again, and it also complicates the structure of Single and Single, because you get these big blocks of text that are up against flashbacks, and then you're back to the present, and it makes it a bit hard to follow. But yeah, I enjoyed them. I thought they were rewarding, and it's nice seeing Brock doing that great intelligence debriefing set piece where you just break down your subject's defenses, kind of war by war, and you know that Brock already knows the answers to his questions before he asks them. And yeah, it's clever, it's great, it's well done, it's great Le Carre set piece stuff. I always really enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like Brock was basically Burrs from the Night Manager brother. You know, I mean, they felt very similar. I mean, it almost felt like, why not just use that character again? I don't feel like I guess I'm blanking on where Burr ended up at the end of Night Manager, but I felt like you could easily have just used that character again in this situation, and because there didn't seem to be anything super distinctive about Brock other than the fact that they're this person doing this job, right?
Yeah, and it would have linked the story in nicely to the Le Carre universe in a way that it doesn't kind of sit. And he does do that sometimes, right? Burr pops up here and there. Harry Palfrey, the dissolute lawyer, pops up through several different novels. You see him in several different places. And it kind of ties you into an imagined Le Carre universe that I always really enjoy. I love seeing characters recover it. But yeah, again, he chooses not to do it in this novel. And that contributes to its feeling a bit set off to one side. In Absent Friends, do we see characters popping up in there again?
I don't think so. I could be off.
Oh, again, we don't. There's a period here where he's writing novels where you're not seeing it kind of engaged in the
larger. there was Russia House, Secret Pilgrim, Night Manager, where they're kind of loosely, there's some intermingling of characters, but then he kind of broke away from that for whatever reason.
Yeah, I like it. I do. I agree. I wonder why he didn't do that, but we don't seem to have an answer.
Let's talk about that ending, because once it starts, I mean, basically the whole thing, for me, the wheels come off as soon as we get Oliver running off with Aggie, because I just didn't buy that from her. I mean, I just really didn't. And I'm assuming you feel similarly. It just didn't feel real. And then the fact that she kind of gets off scot-free also felt like kind of like the head exploding emoji going off in my head when I read that.
That's sort of cop-outs, but I mean, again, we're back to this kind of theme that, you know, the women actualize the men. So there's this moment towards the end of the book where Oliver is bringing down this entire network of Russian oligarchs and getting close to bringing down the corrupt British law enforcement officers who are the target of this operation. He's making his way all over Eastern Europe, and he's got this minder, Aggie, who's a British intelligence babysitter, basically. She's in the Le Carre universe. She's a babysitter. And Oliver tries to throw her off and take off by himself, even though he's in love with her, obviously, and becoming clear that she's falling in love with him. Again, we have this business of Aggie kind of actualizing Oliver into action, being the catalyst that prompts him to the final act into self-realization. But as Oliver tries to throw off Aggie and disappear off by himself for the final stages of the operation, the kind of denouement of the operation, Aggie chucks it all in, all her training, all the professional discipline and everything, says, "I'm coming with you, Oliver, because I love you." And they end up having a passionate night on the train, and they end up bringing the novel to a close, the two of them, in this kind of haze of commitment and realization and redemption. And yeah, it's a bit rich for my blood too, that it was a bit sort of, you could have written that very differently, where Aggie, the professional, actually turns up something interesting or does something interesting or manages to make the plot a little bit more complex or twisty at the end or something. But no, we're left basically with a resolution of a love story. A really quick love story, incidentally, that takes off very quickly for no particular reason.
You get some good stuff with her early on, actually. You know,
she's a great character. I like her. She's a great operative. She's this Scottish, lanky, She's got like a pebble nose and a square chin, and she's obviously extremely tough. She's one of those great Le Carre babysitter characters who's just in charge and knows what to do all the time and is hard as nails, like rock hard. And just, I love those characters. But in the end, she kind of drops all that off and goes all squishy and they fall in love and that's the end of Norm. And yeah, it wasn't the most satisfactory end for me. And it all feels a bit Deus Ex Machina in the way that Brock, the British intelligence officer, and a squad of British Special Operations people come in by helicopter and knock everybody down and arrest everybody, and that's the end of it. It's all a bit resolved, a bit tied up in a way that I hope Le Carré doesn't do his novels, and that spy writers generally don't do, as we were saying earlier. I like it with things like that, a little unresolved.
Yeah, well, and it was odd in a way that it worked out that way, because he was actually doing something kind of interesting just before this, you know, helicopter literally like lands in the last page, you know, where he's got Oliver kind of using his skills that he's learned at his father's knee to kind of create this reversal of fortunes against Hoban, right? You know, he's gotten the oligarch, he's gotten him food, you know, he's kind of changed the dynamic there just through the talking.
We're sat at this incredibly tense dinner, right? Where Oliver is revealing to all these Russians, basically, how much trouble they are in. And these Russians are coming to understand what's happened to them. And we're seeing them all fall apart before our eyes. And it's a rather wonderful scene where Oliver is making them dinner in this house in Georgia. And Tiger Single is sitting there bleeding out of his nose. And at the side of the table, Alex Hoban, this awful villain, you're seeing realization descend upon him. And you're right, it is an interesting moment. I hadn't quite registered that. You're right, it is a fascinating moment. And then Le Carré just kind of wraps it all up. All of a sudden, it just sort of finishes. And you sort of wonder what would have happened if he'd let that spool out more. What if Alex Hoban had got away? You know, what if the Russian lawyer had got away? What if he'd gone on to do other things? What if... I guess part of what Le Carré is trying to do at that point is he's really focusing on Oliver's reconciliation with his father, right? I mean, this is supposed to be the central motif of the end of the book, I think. The emotional clout at the end of the book is supposed to be Oliver coming for and rescuing his father from this ghastly predicament and attempting to find some sort of redemption and forgiveness for everything that he's done. Remember, Oliver has destroyed his own father. He's destroyed his father's bank and his sense of himself, and the illusory world that he has created. So the emotional punch at the end of the book, I think, is supposed to land there. But we're all readers of spy novels, aren't we? we want to see the punch at the end of the book kind of come in the spy story too, right? We want to see how Le Carré's world, his espionage world, resolves itself or doesn't resolve itself. And it feels rather, from the spy novel angle of the book, the espionage fiction perspective of the book, it doesn't feel like that story really gets much of it.
Well, telling. And I think the other half of it is, though, I don't think the redemption arc really ends up landing for me, you know? I mean, because it doesn't feel like, yes, I mean, he's got his dad out of this situation, but there's not a real moment between the two of them, really. I mean, we've had this whole arc throughout that Tiger has told everybody that Oliver has been gone. He's overseas. He's, you know, working for the firm overseas. He's back in school to learn even more. He's been playing this whole fantasy out, even though he knows, right, that he's been betrayed by his son. And we don't ever get, there's nothing there that really plays to that dynamic. And so it just felt like a missed opportunity to me in how it ended.
Yeah, there's that, but we wouldn't want to see them suddenly sort of.
No, but there is. It was just there was a lacking of some sort of acknowledgement there.
But didn't you get the sense of what was happening there? Actually, was Oliver was seeing his father truly for the first time. Tiger Single is sitting there, as we were saying, you know, the bleeding and battered and bruised, talking about the tannins in the wine and maybe, you know, the vintage, and maybe we could set holiday cottages over here. And it's absurd spectacle, grotesque spectacle of this beaten, broken man performing his former sense of self. And Oliver sees this truly for the first. He really sees just what a vacuous character his father is, yet is also moved by compassion for this terrible shrug. I think that's how it's supposed to land. I think that's what Le Carré was trying to do. We see the deep reserves of compassion and empathy in Oliver, and we see Oliver kind of seeing his own predicament in relation to his father, truly. I think that's how it's supposed to be. But it didn't quite, it didn't quite take off.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I don't know that I need them to, you know, collapse into hugs and kisses, but I did need something more. I mean, because I guess for me, it was hard to imagine that Tiger is just utterly, there's nothing there, right? I mean, and I think that's what Lakari is trying to say, and maybe that's just the way he felt about his father, and so that's what he had to put in there. But it just felt hard for me to imagine, and especially because we did get some of that, although, I don't know, he's just relentless with his hatred for Tiger, I guess, in the end, when I think about it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think Lakari has a pretty bleak view of human nature. That's a lot of his books. I mean, and I sort of sympathize with that. I feel like I have met, you know, over my years of a reporter, you know, people who are just so vacuous and plain amoral and without any center to them at all, kind of in that world of international finance and security, and people who are just voids of anything except ambition for social status and the regard of others, and people who, I mean, Le Carre is brutal in his view of many of these men, these characters. So he has absolutely no sympathy for a lot of them, right? I mean, these people do pop up, quite a lot of his spies.
No, that's true. I guess I'm just a little more Pollyanna-ish, you know, hopeful. But one of the other things that I have to say about this ending that is just so felt so un-Le Carre-esque is there's this motorcycle scene. Right? I mean, did that just, like, was that jarring to you as it was to me, where he, like, all of a sudden, Oliver hops on this motorcycle, so it's kind of like Chekhov's motorcycle, we saw it at the beginning, and he hops on it and like, drives out the window and roars off on this mission. It was just so weird to me. I don't know.
Yeah, the motorcycle, this motorbike has a symbolic a role throughout the novel, and clearly that's what, you know, Le Carre is using it. It sits in a living room in the middle of an enormous living room and never gets ridden outside. People just sit on it and rev its engine in Yevgeny's house, in the Russian oligarch's house, and it's just supposed to sit there as a kind of, I don't know what, some kind of trophy, some sort of, but it's a symbol of dysfunction and vanity and idiocy. And in the end, Oliver picks it up and uses it in order to escape and to pursue his mission into the heart of Yevgeny's empire. So yeah, it's a pretty, yeah, you're right. It's a little like Chekhov's gun. It's a little clunky. You know something's going to happen with it at some point, right? But it does. And normally Le Carre doesn't do that right. He's not big on sort of big symbolic. Is he? I can't think of other times when he's really done that. And it does feel it's a bit on the nose.
I mean, I guess,
again,
you know, you think of Tinker Tailor and the owl that comes into the schoolroom that Prido beats down or whatever. I mean, that's kind of a symbolic thing.
Yeah, right? But at least it's a one-off. It doesn't
keep
like
reoccurring.
You see owls the whole trilogy. It's like you see an owl in Act One, you better use that owl by Act Three. You know, it's not that, is it? It's a one-off. I mean, there's Smiley's lighter, of course. Okay, there is that. Maybe there are other times where he objectifies him, but this was a particular.
I think it's the motorcycle roaring off kind of thing is what made it feel a little egregious in my mind. So,
what's your favorite Le Carre novel?
Oh, my favorite.
When you're sick, like when you're ill, you've got a really bad dose of flu or a stomach upset or something, and you withdraw to your room to get over it, which is the Le Carre novel you pick up?
I mean, the one that I've read the most is The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. That's the one that I've read the most of.
Ooh, okay.
I don't know if it's necessarily my favorite. I want to pick up again. I haven't read it in a long time now, but the first time I read it, I just loved it. It was Our Game, which is a little bit of an off kind of choice, but he was trying something different in that one, I felt. And I really, I was interested in that.
Yeah, I haven't read that one in a long time either. I must pick that up again. This has motivated me to go back and look at other ones that sort of stand a little bit away from his huge, most famous works. The Mission Song is one I want to go to as well. and The Constant Gardener. When they get adapted for film, I do find that the film tends to live on in my mind in a way that, slightly seems to stop me going back to the novel. I don't quite know why.
Especially The Constant Gardener, I would say especially. I think that movie improved the book in so many different ways. I think that movie was really amazing. And, you know, and it frankly kind of fixed the issue with Tessa that you have in the novel, I thought. And, and just the performances were really great. So I think that was one definitely improved when it went to the screen.
And again, he's stepping out from, I mean, very little kind of overt sort of intelligence stuff, way less kind of tradecrafty establishment sort of stuff. Yeah, again, I haven't read the book in quite a while. I should go back and look at that too. No, it's fascinating just kind of going over the structure of his career and looking at the ways he adapted at different times to the material that was available to him, and also clearly public taste. Maybe I'm a bit of a bore and by always falling back on the early novels. Maybe I should be looking harder at his latest stuff. Some of those post 9/11. Too, I think it was good.
Well, with Our Game, I just loved the kind of unreliable narrator that he was using in that one. I think it might have been the first time that he was doing an overt, like, kind of first person telling of a story as well, which I thought was really interesting.
Right. Yeah. He was, and that was a very strong voice too, wasn't it? And again, he had a wonderful grasp on of the kind of sort of language and idiom of the character. I'm struggling to get back into the details.
What did you think of Single and Single and its voice? Because it has a very distinct way of telling the story. You know, you talked about these kind of flash forwards and back. It's got just it's not your typical kind of way of telling a story. It's almost like this kind of half conversational method. I don't know if that's making any sense to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a point of view thing. Again, you sort of flicker into people's heads and you hear their internal thought processes. And then you flicker out from their heads and you see them from another perspective. So, I mean, the novel is told from multiple points of view. Now you see it through the eyes of Brock, the intelligence officer. Now you're seeing it through the eyes of Oliver, but always a very limited perspective. Now you're seeing it from somebody else. And sometimes we're omniscient and sometimes we're not. He uses this technique a good deal where you get little flickers of thought from inside people's heads. The opening line, "This gun is not a gun," is an example of that. What you're seeing there is from inside the lawyer Windsor's head. You're seeing the gun appear in front of his face, and you're seeing the disbelief from inside Windsor's head. And that pops up all the way through. You're constantly hearing little bits of internal dialogue from people. And Le Carre does that elsewhere. It's a technique he uses quite a lot. He uses it a great deal in Single and Single. And the voice it's written a bit more kind of, it's a bit more fraught. It's a bit more kind of, sometimes Le Carre writes very stripped down and very cool and cold. And sometimes he goes much kind of warmer and more fraught and kind of electrified. And, you know, sentences get longer, they get more convoluted. There's more kind of these flashes of insight and flickery, jittery kind of takes that people have. And there's a lot of that in Single and Single. Often that stuff calms down when you're in the presence of a thoughtful, quiet intelligence officer like Brock. You know, the prose comes down 10 notches on the dial, and then you get back into the head of Oliver Single or Alfred Windsor. It's suddenly massing, you know, it's suddenly all over the place again. It's chaotic. So there's quite a bit of variety, but the book as a whole leans towards this jittery, unstable voice that again, is very difficult to pull off. It's very difficult to do. Most writers are content to do a chronological narrative where one thing happens after another and an omniscient narrator takes you by the hand, walks you through it, and explains what's going on. That's not Le Carre, and his genius lies in his ability to tell you a very complex story in this very unstable way. And Single and Single maybe isn't the greatest example of his doing that. A Perfect Spies, again, is the greatest example of his doing that, where you're seeing this constant internal dialogue from Le Carre's own father, just flashing all over the screen in front of you.
For me, I think we've talked about some of the negatives of this, but there's always like just such flashes of great writing, though. I mean, one where he's talking about when, you know, we talked about the blood, right? The blood stuff, where they're going to parcel up this blood and sell it off there. And there's this one line where he's saying, Soviet citizens are accustomed to giving blood freely and spontaneously in moments of particular empathy or patriotism, not, God forbid, on a commercial basis, says Hoban, in a voice now so anemic that Oliver wonders whether he himself could do with the transfusion. I loved that line, you know, but those types of things are peppered throughout the book, you know, and that's why it's so fun to read.
It's such a horrible concept that you're dealing with, but Le Carré manages to make it all the more grotesque by injecting that slight note of hysterical humor, and hysterical in the sense of like losing control, panic. Although the humor is always on the verge of like bursting through in this ghastly, grotesque sort of panicky feel. That's a great example of that. Yeah, and I love the way that Le Carré is able to do it so consistently too. I mean, he's just able to do it on every page.
Was this the first time that we've seen Le Carré reference James Bond in one of his novels? Did you catch that?
I did not. Where does he do that? I missed that.
This is when Brock was talking with Heather, who is Oliver's ex-wife, right? And he says, when you take on a Joe, you take on his problems, he would preach to his newcomers. You're not Machiavelli. You're not James Bond. You're the overworked welfare officer who's got to hold everybody's life together or somebody will run amok.
Right, huh. That didn't register with me. Is that the only time? Yeah, I can't think of another place where he does that.
I didn't get a chance to check in my other and some of the other books, but I mean, knowing his disdain for James Bond is pretty well known out there. I just thought that was an interesting thing for him to slip in there.
Yeah, so it's almost some slightly barbed, isn't it? It's quite an obvious thing to say. I mean, I'm not sure Le Carré readers would have any trouble with that proposition.
The thing with Le Carré, you know, ripping on James Bond is so interesting to me because a friend sent me something about what Fleming had said about The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and he was really very complimentary about the book and Le Carré and his writing, which just makes it all the kind of more amusing that he had no problem ripping into Fleming and Bond and giving him such a hard time.
Yeah. And one can see why. It's always felt to me like Le Carré is a man with kind of, he was quite happy to carry a grudge. He was not a particularly forgiving character himself in a number of ways. And it doesn't surprise me that he would resent living in the shadow, commercially living in the shadows, perfection that was Fleming's world. I find it fascinating that as the books continue, the Bond books continue to get written by other spy writers, and particularly the movies continue to get made, they start leaning towards a Le Carré-ish take on Bond. And the end of the Daniel Craig reign in the Bond movies feels way more Le Carré than it feels Fleming.
Yeah.
Right. So maybe Le Carré gets the last laugh in the end. Even though James Bond has become cliche.
Well, there's a great line in the Book of Letters. I don't know if you've read that yet. Yeah,
I have not.
There's a line that it's not from one of his letters, but it's referenced from somebody who knew him and says that he wrote the way he did about spies because he never took part in a successful operation, which I thought was a rather interesting take on his novels.
Oh, fascinating. Fascinating.
So could you see this being adapted for television? I'm curious, or a film?
No, I think it would have happened by now if it was going to happen, wouldn't it? I don't think the female characters hold water strongly enough, and partly because of its very jittery structure and the flashbacks and things, I think that makes it a much tougher adaptation. It doesn't have the big story beats like a novel like The Night Manager has. The Night Manager has got wonderful episodic sections to it, even though it also works in flashback. But you can see very clearly where you are in The Night Manager. And you've got these different settings that work very well for TV episodes. So you don't quite have that the same way in Single and Single. It just doesn't feel like the ending in Single and Single is a sufficient culmination, does it? I mean, we just pulled it apart. I think it would be very difficult to end up in that place on a 6-part TV series. I think it would be pretty hard to finish up there. with, you know, the defining love affair of the entire story starting literally 10 minutes before the end. I can see why structurally a scriptwriter would have real problems with it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in my mind, could I see it? Yes. I think they'd really have to kind of blow it up and put it back together again. You know, maybe Aggie is Brock, right? I mean, maybe we don't have Brock.
You'd have to, bring down the cast of characters.
And that way she's there from the start and you can kind of play it out that way. It does have these kind of episodic feel to it to a certain extent, where he's going to visit all these various different people. So maybe you could play it that way. But I do think you're right. You'd need to really kind of turn it into something that doesn't resemble the book in a way that the night manager felt like it still resembled the book.
And and also, I mean, Oliver, I find it quite hard to actually visualize him. We do get some physical description of him, and we get his magic and his sleight of hand, and we get his very intense and troubled relationship with his father. But there's something about Jonathan Pine in The Night Manager that is totally magnetic, and you can't take your eyes off him. And he has this extraordinary métier, which is his hotel life, in sharp contrast to his previous military life. And it all just makes perfect emotional and psychological sense. Pine is an incredibly well-drawn, well-put-together. Your imagination rushes in, and in a way that, for me, doesn't quite rush in on Oliver in Single and Single. It's not just it doesn't make him an uninteresting character in Single and Single, but he's just not quite as delineated. He's a bit all over the place in a way that Pine possesses this razor-sharp intensity that Tom Hiddleston then brings out so fantastically. I mean, who would you cast as Oliver Single? I'm trying to imagine who would put in that role. You couldn't have a wonderful floppy-haired, a fabulous British actor. You couldn't have a Tom Hiddleston. It's somebody sort of lumpy and all over the place and ill-defined and emotionally a bit incontinent, and we don't quite know why they're doing what they're doing. Who's also doing magic? I mean, it's not a very visually coherent character.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the beaches of Majorca to some little kid's birthday party with a magician, not quite the same, not like for like there when it comes to a television adaption.
No, with the Night Manager, you had this fantastic setting that in the book was a yacht. But they decided not to make a yacht in the TV adaptation. They made it this villa in southern Spain, which is just this terrific, atmospheric, very visually well-defined setting for the whole novel, the whole story. And everything in that setting, for me, works fantastically well. Works less well when you go off and you see all the explosions and stuff. But again, I'm not sure that Single and Single has that incredibly well-defined visual setting that TV producers look for. They really want a single place that you come to inhabit, and the viewer asks themselves consistently, wow, what would it be like for me if I lived there? Could that be me? That's what the TV producers are always looking for, that reaction in the viewer. Could that be me? Could I be in that situation? What would it be like for me in that situation? And you need strong, coherent visual settings for that. And hotels and that wonderful villa provide you with that in The Night Manager in a way that I think you'd be hard put to get that visceral visual connection with you, Single and Single. And they struggled with in the Carla trilogy too. Right? I mean, it's hard for them to adapt the Carla trilogy visually because of that slight lack of setting. I mean, they've done it, and they've done it very successfully, but it wasn't easy.
Yeah, I mean, I think you get that great opening, though. I mean, that is seared into your mind. So there's that aspect of it in the book. And Single and Single, the actual, like, location of where they were, the office, sits in my mind as well.
Yeah, the bangs. But again, the reason that that chapter works, the opening works so well, I think, is because of the point of view thing. And then you're flickering in and out. And you can't do that on camera. You don't get internal dialogue on camera. You can only outside. So you've got a real problem there with that interiority around which Single and Single turns so much, in particular that fabulous opening scene. I think it would be very hard to write that for a screenplay.
Anything else on this single and single that we...
I think we've sliced and diced
it. Pick the bones clean. I just have to throw in there, I think the U.S. cover of the original hardcover, I always didn't like it. It's this orange cover with like yellow, but then when I looked at it, it really is kind of cool. It's got this like, you see the two tigers kind of going at each other. The UK version is just this black, kind of black and gold. It did not work for me, but I thought that was the U.S. one. They did do a good job on that. And I imagine Lacari was involved in that because as you read in his letters, he really did care about the way his books looked.
Oh, really? He was involved in the covers?
He was, yeah. And so, and especially with the reissues recently that they did of all the covers, the artist, he would go back and forth with the artist because I guess, and it's not surprising, he was an artist himself. So, you know, drawing all
right.
the time.
Right. So the mark of a truly successful novelist is when they get to like have influence. Most of us don't.
Right? I mean, that's the crazy part. I thought this was fun to reread. I appreciated the good parts and was less enamored with some of the other stuff. But would you recommend folks go out there and pick it up, do a reread if they?
I would recommend everybody always to read as much Le Carré as they can. I think he's one of the most important post-war novelists in English, and he's an object lesson in how you bust artificial boundaries between the literary and the commercial, and he's the ultimate crossover writer, and his characters are just formidable, and his sense of the world and the moment that he inhabits and the psychology of a country through the end of the Cold War and into this whatever we now call this moment that we live in now, his sense of transition and his ability to capture these moments are just unparalleled. He's just absolutely wonderful.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining me here. If folks want to find your work, what's the best way for them to do that?
They can go to my website, adambrooks.com. They can look on Amazon for my spy novels, The Night Heron Trilogy, or my new nonfiction book, Fragile Cargo, which is out in the United States. Yeah, I'm not hard to find. I'm on Twitter at @AdamBooksWord. Look me up.
All right. Well, I've read all of those books, and I recommend them to everybody. So I hope folks pick them up after your very perceptive comments on Le Carré here. Thank you so much for joining me. That's going to wrap it up for this episode. I'll have links to all of the various things we discussed today in the show notes and on the episode page at lecarrecast.com. If you enjoyed the show, you'd be doing me a huge favor by subscribing and reviewing it on Apple Podcasts. It helps everybody else wondering if they should listen to a podcast on Le Carré find the show. Drop us a comment on the website or on Twitter at lecarrecast. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Like what you're listening to? There's more like it. Barbican Station explores the spy world of Slough House and the Slow Horses created by author Mick Herron. Find it online at slough.house or in your favorite podcast app under Barbican Station. Spybrary's Spy Rewind uses one episode of a classic spy TV show like Mission Impossible, Alias, or Get Smart to talk about the show as a whole. It's at spybrary.com or search for Spybrary in your podcast app. Like the Wolf is a podcast dedicated to the Nero Wolf mystery series created by Rex Stout. The podcast has reviews of all of his stories, plus interviews with a wide variety of Wolf fans. Find it in your podcatcher under Like the Wolf or at likethewolf.com. That's Wolf with an E. They're all novel podcasts, and you can find them all if you type novel.network in your browser. That's novel.network.